proceed to the fourth case of the morning. United States versus Eddie Ellis. Mr. Kim.
Good morning, Your Honor, Counsel. May it please the Court. This case presents two issues. First is whether Ellis's Fourth Amendment rights were violated at the so-called stop that led to all the evidence against him. This is the motion to suppress issue. And second, whether Ellis's sentence of 210 months is unjustifiably disparate and thus requires resentencing. These two issues are independent, although a favorable finding on the first would moot the second, and thus, subject to your questions, I will concentrate my argument on the first issue. On the first issue, the Fourth Amendment motion to suppress issue, I think it's clear from the record, and indeed I don't think the government argues otherwise, that there was no probable cause here to stop, arrest, seize, or however you classify Ellis when he was stopped and pulled out of his car that led to the discovery of the cocaine in his trunk. Indeed, in light of this case, this court's decision in Ingrow, I'm not sure how it could be possible that there was probable cause. That leaves either the government or this court with three other rationales to affirm here. One, that Ellis wasn't arrested or seized within the meaning of Fourth Amendment, or at least not in such a way that probable cause was necessary. Or alternatively, that Ellis either somehow forfeited this Fourth Amendment argument, or that there was some issue of consent that otherwise obviates the Fourth Amendment argument.
Well, there's the reasonable suspicion for a preliminary Terry type stop, and they see Ellis hanging around by the trunk of the car, you know, with these guys as the duffel bags move in and out. I mean, Ellis is plainly in the picture and actually trades cars from the intrepid to the intrigue, right?
That's correct.
It didn't strike me as odd, really, that the police officers, using the term generically, the federal officers, the local officers, thought that there was some reason to pull Ellis over, that he was involved with an illegal transaction. Indeed, even without the evidence of the marijuana deal they thought they were investigating, we've seen cases of personal involvement in suspicious activity like this. I think this does go beyond the facts of the earlier case.
I guess I disagree only to a point. I think that Ingrow is incredibly on point. Obviously, all cases are distinguishable at some level, at some factual basis. I think the biggest distinction from Ingrow is that there the government just conceded that it was an arrest. So perhaps this is the question that's left open in Ingrow, whether there's probable cause, and if so, whether that might have been enough to have led to what happened.
But there was more in this case to link Ellis himself to some suspicious activities, not just walking in and out of a house.
Indeed, he doesn't even walk in the house.
No, but he's standing there by the trunk and investigating, looking under the hood, you know.
He actually never stands
by with the people who are doing something in a way that's visible.
Well, there's no question he had some interaction with these people. And in fact, that all becomes clear at trial. But at the motion to suppress, what you have is that he never goes into the apartment. He never, indeed, goes near the trunk. Never can even be placed with seeing any of the purportedly suspicious duffel bags that are described at only an incredibly vague level of detail. Instead, I think what's almost striking about what is at the motion express, after all the other omissions, is there's a lot of testimony about him being around the hood area, the engine area of the car, that leads absolutely nowhere. I'm not even sure how that comes in or if it even matters, but I do find it striking just in comparison to the amount of vagary or omissions that are left in the record otherwise.
I thought Ellis was standing outside when they put the duffel bag in the trunk. He's behaving in a way that makes it look like he's acting as a lookout. He's standing by the car. He's looking around. Then he actually gets into the car that has the duffel bag and drives it off.
Right, I mean, there's no question that what Ellis does is drive there with another car and swaps cars.
And stands there looking around while other people are shifting duffel bags around. Right.
There is some testimony about looking around. It's pretty vague, and I'm not sure how that really distinguishes that from Ingrow, which also has this general vague looking around testimony.
Well, the striking thing to me is that if we were to take this activity in isolation, where somebody on routine patrol sees this, what you just described, and then comes up with a reasonable suspicion, the striking thing here is there happen to be two concurrent drug deals going on at the same time in the same place, all and very similar, with duffel bags. And these guys, unfortunately, carried theirs out before the others did, I guess. And so they're coming out of the house with the duffel bags, and the surveillance is aware of this. So whatever reasonable suspicion, maybe they don't deserve it. But the police officer, at least in good faith, thinks this is the same folks who they're supposed to be watching, and they are doing, as Judge Wood described, a lot of things that profile people who are in the course of a drug transaction. And then they follow them, of course, proves to be correct. Unfortunately for them, that it was a different drug transaction.
Well, I mean, it's obviously true that at the end of the day, there's drugs in the car that Ellis was involved in, and we wouldn't be here. And that's true for every motion to suppress hearing. But I think the issue is that if you try and look back at what those officers knew at the time, I think what's striking is just what they know they don't know. It begins better than most drug transactions with a controlled delivery of marijuana, and no one's able to identify how that marijuana is delivered. 100 pounds in three black bags, maybe black duffel bags. Maybe there's some talk about it having yellow and blue striping at the beginning. Later on, there's talk of red and green striping being observed at the residence in Rockford. They know from the beginning they can't. In fact, the same Special Agent Sister, who was involved in the controlled delivery out at the motel, and then followed the two Hispanics that are not, we don't have any more identifying information about them other than two Hispanic men, that are what leads them to this residence. Even that agent that was involved in the controlled delivery cannot say with any certainty at all that what he sees go in the apartment was the same bag or not the same bag as what was involved in the controlled delivery. They know from the beginning that they don't know a lot about what's going on. They know that they don't know anything about this residence, whether it's a known drug house or not. They don't know anything about Fermetta, who it turns out we later learn is the person that lives there, and they see him. They don't know who he is. They don't know that he lives there. They don't know anything about the bag that Fermetta brings into the house. They know that there's a gap in surveillance, a pretty decent 20-minute gap. They have no idea what happens in between there. We don't know how the cocaine gets into Ellis' car. It could have easily happened in the 20 minutes. Obviously, at the end of the day, they get lucky and they catch the drugs, but I don't think that's the issue on a motion to suppress. And, I guess the only other issue is the sentencing issue. I think we conceded in our brief that there seems to be some confusion, or at least there's confusion on the part of counsel about exactly how to proceed. I think that there's a clear disparity, and obviously we are going to brief, there's a clear disparity. I think the bigger issue is on what basis this court can review that. Brumley, this court's decision in Brumley makes clear that it could not be reviewed if it was clear that the district court understood what it was doing, understood that it has discretion, and just consciously chose to not exercise it. I think the record is clear enough with the district court judge's quote that the only way I can help you now would be, in essence, to violate the law, that it wasn't so clear to the district court judge. So I don't think that's a bar. Other than that, I think there's some other unresolved issues, and we just look to the court for guidance up to your questions.
Okay, thanks. Ms. Bass.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Timothy Bass on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, with respect to the motion to suppress issue, as Judge Wood suggested, the reason why probable cause was not at issue in this case, and because this Court's decision in Ingrail is, for the most part, irrelevant, is because the officers only needed reasonable suspicion to stop that car, which, as the Supreme Court has told us, is a standard that is considerably less than probable cause. And what is fatal to the defendant's argument throughout his brief and before the court today is his repeated assertions about what the officers didn't know.
Can I just clarify, there's no argument anywhere in this record that the stop of the car was because they forgot to turn their left signal on or any of these other trivial traffic stop reasons that sometimes appear. They stopped the car because they thought the drugs were in it.
That's correct, Your Honor, which, okay. And as the court is aware, the police officers can stop a car, execute a traffic stop for any violation, whether it be a traffic violation or any other reasonable suspicion of criminal activity, in this case, the transportation of marijuana. And there were numerous articulable facts that the officers had that provided a reasonable basis for them to stop the car. Those included actual knowledge that marijuana had been transported to that residence in three duffel bags, two duffel bags had been taken into the residence, one by a Hispanic male, another by a black male. Shortly thereafter, the defendant arrives with two other black males who go around to the back of the, one of which goes around to the back of the residence, then reemerges from the back of the residence with an Hispanic male, carrying a duffel bag. The defendant, in the meantime, is standing as a lookout in front of the residence. Once all these individuals join again in the front of the residence, there are duffel bags exchanged between these individuals.
You would say for the reasonable suspicion standard, it doesn't make any difference. The duffel bags could have been full of Barbie dolls, and it still would have been fine. They still would have been able to stop the car.
Yes, Your Honor, because what happened, just as the officers cannot rely on facts that occurred after the incident, what we know after the fact does not determine the reasonableness of the decision at the time.
And I suppose the question is it's still a reasonable decision to think that the duffel bags have drugs in them, that they thought marijuana, I realize, with the 20-minute gap in time that Mr. Kim has stressed and the other failures to keep the dots connected throughout this transaction?
Your Honor, I would concede that fact, as well as the other facts, are all factors that go into the mix. I don't think the simple fact that there was a 20-minute gap is necessarily dispositive. Because if you look at all the factors, again, the transportation of marijuana to the residence, the taking of duffel bags into the residence, the transporting of a duffel bag from the rear of the residence, the exchange of duffel bags in the front of the residence, the defendant acting as a lookout, and the defendant then getting into a car, driving away from the residence that contains a duffel bag, which is a different car than that which he drove to the residence, are certainly, surely articulable facts that the officers could reasonably believe that the defendant was engaged in criminal activity. And again, the issue is not what the defendant continues to argue, actual knowledge. The standard is not hard certainty, it is reasonable belief. And there were numerous facts upon which the officers could reasonably conclude that the defendant was engaged in a criminal activity. And immediately following the stop, and this is the issue that is waived or forfeited on appeal, immediately following the stop, the defendant was asked if he had any drugs or guns in the car. He denied that it was his car, and he consented to a search. Now that argument, the challenge to that evidence, was never advanced in the district court. It only was contained in a one-sentence in a two-page motion to suppress. It was never raised again.
Well, that was my understanding is why Mr. Ellis is stressing so much that he's got to attack this at the moment of the stop, not beyond that, because if you get beyond the actual stop, then he is faced with the consent that you just mentioned. But if they couldn't have stopped the car to begin with, that conversation wouldn't have happened.
I agree, Your Honor. And even though I think the record supports that there was probable cause to stop the car and search it, we didn't argue that in our brief, and so we're not arguing that here today. But that is not necessary, given that the officer's actions were justified based on a much lower standard. If there are no other questions as to the traffic stop, I would like to make one comment about the sentencing disparity. Your Honor, as we argue in our brief, it's our position that this court lacks jurisdiction to consider this claim. The sentencing disparity issue was not precisely advanced to the district court. This court's authority based on sentencing disparity was never made known to the district court. The argument that is advanced here today that district court may have misunderstood its authority to depart, that was only raised in their reply brief, which is not something that is proper to do. Even assuming this court does have jurisdiction to consider the claim, the sentencing disparity in this case is not the result of any incorrect application of the sentencing guidelines. It's solely the result of decisions made by Mr. Ellis. He, prior to the decisions of these co-defendants, who were admittedly more culpable, he himself had the opportunity to plead guilty and to cooperate with the government. He chose not to do so, which was his right. But he cannot now stand before this court and say that because my co-defendants who pled guilty, who cooperated with the government, and received, because of that, received reduced sentences. That somehow gives me the ability to ask a district court to grant a downward departure to my sentence. In other words, his argument is that simply because I may have been less culpable than my co-defendant, I can go to trial, refuse to cooperate, and still get a downward departure. And I would submit to the court that that is a frivolous argument. The only reason why Mr. Ellis was sentenced to the sentence he was because of the decisions he made. And this court has held on numerous occasions that that is never a basis for a downward departure. So, Your Honors, if there are no other questions, the government would ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
Mr. Kim, you've got 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just 4 points I'd like to try and squeeze in these 2 minutes. First, just to go back to the standard review, obviously the government talks about Ellis acting as a lookout. There's some questions here, too. That's fine for an argument, but there's no findings of fact below about that. You can find the findings of fact such as they are at page 104 of the transcript, which is page 110 of our appendix. There are some findings of fact about dark bags going in the house, dark bags coming out of the house, and it ends up in the vehicle being driven by the defendant. I think that's essentially the sum total of the findings of fact. Otherwise, we're on a de novo review here. So maybe he's a lookout, maybe he's not. What we have is just testimony of looking around. It's pretty vague. Similarly, as to the traffic stop, the government is free to argue that it's a traffic stop, but the bottom line is, at the end of the day where we are now, there's very little evidence in the record about how that was a traffic stop. There's
often Do you disagree that the police have the authority to stop a car not because they think the driver is committing violations of traffic laws, but because they have a reasonable suspicion that some other criminal activity is going on? They have a reasonable suspicion there's a kidnapped victim in the car. They have a reasonable suspicion there are drugs in the car. They have a reasonable suspicion, fill in the blank, some other criminal activity. Because I understood that to be the government's argument, not that it was a traffic stop in the narrow sense of the term.
I've assumed it to be true, and I have to apologize that I can't tell the court for certain if it is true. We've tried to make a hard look at these kind of Terry stop cases, and there's obviously plenty of cases that start as traffic stops. There's plenty of cases where they start where the government has some general suspicion, shots fired, and officers come to the scene, and they hear a description of a black car, they stop black cars, or a white car in D.C., or whatever the case may be. I couldn't find a case, and I was hoping to find a case, just to let us know one way or the other, where they're really trying to find something. I mean, we know what they're doing here. They're under strict orders to stop the marijuana. That testimony is clear in the record. I've assumed, without knowing whether it's true or not, that police officers could do an investigation, stop short of probable cause, and say, you know what, skip it. That's too much trouble. Let's just go on reasonable suspicion. We even assume that, though, for the purposes of this appeal. But the problem still is that the government, even on a reasonable suspicion Terry stop, the government has to show that what happened on the stop is commensurate with the lower burden the Fourth Amendment places on Terry stops. The record is devoid of exactly how that stop went. There's no testimony about who shows up to actually pull Ellis out of the car, whether guns are drawn, whether lights and sirens are going, or any of those contextual issues. And the contextual issue also goes to the issue of consent. I'm sorry I'm out of time.
Okay. Thanks very much. I understand you were appointed for this, right? We appreciate your acceptance of the appointment and your vigorous support for your client.
Thank you, Ron.
Go on to the